The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. This is a fun show, folks. I mean, this is a really fun show. Even though there are two economists right at the top of the show, this, I guarantee you, is a fun show. This hour, a look at indecipherable subcultures, one which affects the entire global economy but is understood by perhaps a dozen people, and we have two of them here. The subculture called the Federal Reserve. They are about to raise short-term benchmark interest rates. One small step for them, one giant leap for the global economy. The other indecipherable subculture affects no one in any significant way, except it's entertaining, but it's understood by much of the planet, the Star Wars subculture. If you have seen none of the previous episodes of the Star Wars franchise, if Darth Vader and Death Stars mean nothing to you, worry not. The Takeaway is with you. We can do some deciphering for you, at least enough to get you through the new film, The Force Awakens, or a holiday party of the Forceful. More about that later. Also, we'll have another look at the energy industry responding to Paris, corporate campaign contributions, and the practice of moving offshore to avoid taxes. And journalist Linda Ellerby says goodbye to being the news mentor and listener to two generations of young, curious news hounds. But we begin with the Fed decision and how this might be the end of an era for monetary policy and the end of a global consensus among central banks around the world. Two top economists are with us. Richard Silla is professor of economics at New York University's Stern School of Business. He's co-author of A History of U.S. Interest Rates. Professor, welcome.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Also with us is Diane Swonk, senior managing editor and chief economist at Mesirow Financial. Diane, welcome.
Always good to be here. Thank you.
All right. So let's start with the Fed's decision itself. Interest rates are going to go up. It seems to – I talked with someone very, very senior formerly with the administration recently who said – the Fed has done such a good job of blunting the significance of this impact that even though it is the end of an era, it will go over like, you know, a whisper. It will have very, very little tangible effect. Richard?
Well, we'll have to wait and see. I mean, I think the move that everyone is expecting has been so well forecast. And, you know, the Fed said, I think, a year ago that they would raise in 2015. This is their last chance, really. They've been saying recently that they're going to raise. And I think it would be a tremendous shock if they did not raise.
And tremendous shocks is not a feature of the Yellen tenure at the Federal Reserve. Is that right, Diane?
This is something, no, she would not lock, although in September it did shock some that the Fed actually delayed until December. I think it's important to remember that this is something that's been in the Fed's psyche since 2012, when they first gave us this concept that they were going to hold rates low for a really long time, and they sort of put on it a calendar date of 2015, and there's this sense of whether it's even the last days of the year they want to make that mark of saying, what they said in 2012, by the end of 2015, we will be raising rates and be in a good enough world, a world that will be tolerant enough for us to raise rates, an economy strong enough to raise rates. That's what they hope to be at tomorrow.
Let's talk historically. The rates, we're told, are near zero now. But in historical terms, is that really true? Can we compare the interest rates of today with the interest rates of two generations ago?
Well, we can obviously compare them, and I would say they are very low. In fact, they're among the lowest rates in recorded history. When you're down around 0% or sometimes in Europe, even negative interest rates they talk about, that's kind of unprecedented. The previous –
and when you say recorded history, you literally mean going back to like the Sumerians, right?
Oh, sure. Code of Hammurabi.
Right. Okay.
But, you know, the most recent period when rates were this low were sort of on the eve of the U.S. entry into World War I back in 1940 and 41. And we've gone below those rates now. They were down close to zero, but, you know, somewhat above zero. And lately we've had kind of zero interest rates.
Diane, is the Fed responding to job data? Is the Fed responding to inflation, which is the traditional response of the Fed? Or is the Fed just kind of going, we're getting really scared here doing this for so long, and they got to get out of it?
You know, it's all of the above. I think all of the above, quite notably. One of the interesting issues is that during the height of the crisis, and it depends on which metrics you use, that the Fed really believed, and there is a lot of analysis supporting this, that rates, in order to allow the economy to come back more naturally in the wake of the crisis, they would have had to go down almost 5%. Well, they considered, the Federal Reserve considered zero the boundary. It's not something that all of our European counterparts have considered, although they're having some problems of their own with negative interest rates. And we couldn't go down below zero. So this many years later, actually, it's 7 years to the day tomorrow of when they pushed rates to zero. They're looking at it saying, we're finally, it's not that rates have been at zero for so long, it's that we couldn't get them below that. So we had to keep up at zero longer and do other things with their balance sheet and try to help long-term rates come down. And now we're finally ready to move a little bit off that zero bound because the economy's healed enough that those negative rates aren't justified anymore. And maybe some little bit of positive rates. And the sense is that, you know, yes, it could be a whisper. The reality, though, is that we don't know how this interest rate change will ripple through the rest of the world, nor even our own bond markets. And I know that's a bit arcane to people thinking about it, but you could have distortions where all of a sudden short-term rates like 1 or 2 year loans spike, even as long-term rates remain low as the Fed goes through these levers that it's using to change. It's sort of telling in and of itself, the Fed can't hit an actual target on short-term rates anymore. They can't just say, hey, the rate's 0.25% now. They're going to say the rate's between 0.25% and 0.5%, and we're going to hit it, we think, pretty close to the middle part of that range, and we're going to do all the trading operations we can to have that happen. But it may miss a smidge here and there each day, and it may cause distortions in money market versus what you see at your bank account. And this is a little different world because they're using levers that they've never been able to test in the magnitude that we're talking about.
All right, let's talk about those levers. The levers are the asset purchases or the asset sales, right? They're going to take stuff from their balance sheets that they've been buying. They've been essentially buying the money that they're printing. At least that's the very cynical view of it. Now they're going to sell that slowly, and that selling is going to raise the interest rate, Richard?
Oh, sure, John. When the Fed purchases assets, government bonds or mortgage-backed securities, that pushes their prices up and their yields down. So you're moving rates closer to, you know, lower levels, even zero. Now, when the Fed says its goal is to raise interest rates, it may sell some of those assets that it previously bought.
So there's more on the market. Because there's more on the market, you have to raise the yield to make them attractive.
Right, to get people to buy those securities the Fed is selling, the Fed may have to lower the price, which raises the yield. Mm-hmm. And that's how the Fed raises interest rates.
What if the rest of the economy says, okay, we think you're bluffing the Fed and nobody buys these things and the interest rates really start to spike? Is that a scenario that could happen, Diane?
Yeah, the reason I'm jumping in is because these levers that the Fed is using are so different. Their actual balance sheet of what they carry, they're going to keep constant. They want to keep it elevated to be able to sort of keep an anchor on long-term rates. Say, if China were all of a sudden tomorrow to have to sell a lot of treasury bonds, they don't want long-term rates and mortgage rates to go with them to spike really quickly. On the flip side of it, though, what the Fed has said, we're going to use something that's really kind of not very liquid right now. It's called the reverse repo market. It gets into money market funds. This is very technical. We're going to use this market to try to move, create a floor on interest rates. We're going to raise interest rates a little bit through that floor, and the ceiling will be the interest that we charge on reserves that banks hold at the Federal Reserve, hoping that will put a ceiling on rates. But these mechanisms that the Fed has have been tested, but never tested in the sheer magnitude of what we'll need to see to move them economy-wide. And what we don't know are the ripple effects on other markets. We do know that most emerging markets are doing better than they once were, but it's very telling that China itself, as it moves to be more of a reserve currency, their currency is no longer pegged to the dollar. It's saying, listen, we want to peg it to a spectrum of currencies that we think more reflects it. It's that very fear that the dollar may move as the Fed raises interest rates that is causing China to sort of cushion the blow. Now, places like Turkey, Brazil, Russia, they have less of a cushion and they could be more at risk. Other emerging markets, South Africa is another one. Other emerging markets have done better in recent months and are more prepared for this, but it really is uneven. And there's also a divergence in monetary policy between the Fed is at this stage where it's saying we're ready to go a little bit And then you've got, say, the European Central Bank, the Bank of Japan, that's planning to meet later this week, saying other developed countries saying, we want to ease a little further. We want to support our economy a little longer. So that divergence, as subtle as it seems, creates a very dynamic dance. And it's one that's not entirely predictable. So as much as we'd like this to be a whisper, and I certainly hope it is, there is chances here that I think those at the Federal Reserve working the New York trading desk that are going to execute these operations, they're not going to get much of a vacation this holiday season. They'll be working as hard as they can to make sure that we see very little of these distortions that come through. But that's where the risk is.
All right. We'll talk about indecipherable subcultures. Diane Swonk, you really sort of swept us over the entire domain there. What was the term she used, the reserve repo market?
Reverse repo market.
Reverse repo market.
Right. You sort of sell some securities and then buy them back the next day, and that can affect the interest rates overnight.
Something I never do. Richard Silla, professor of economics at New York University. Is the Fed responding to the global economy? I mean, are they concerned about these emerging markets that may have different impacts, or are they much more concerned about the U.S. economy, and that's really the gold standard for them?
Well, I think this move is mostly concerned with the U.S. economy. Actually, the emerging markets are kind of worried about this, because if the Fed raises rates in dollars, that strengthens the U.S. dollar, and that makes it tougher for other countries to support their currency levels. I think that, you know, the Fed is paying attention to the world, and, you know, in some ways, if they looked at the whole world, they might not do this now. But they've created a lot of liquidity here in our U.S. economy. Our economy is doing not great, but better than most of the rest of the world. And the Fed is worried about inflation going up, and so they want to stop that before it happens, which is what they should do, I think. But I think this move is basically focused on the U.S. economy, and people in the rest of the world don't exactly like it all that much.
Well, economists are going to know after, you know, this week whether all their predictions, as Diane was talking about all this quantitative easing and these low interest rates, what the impact is, if that's going to come true, if we've entered an era that is just truly indecipherable. The era of near zero interest rates is probably over. Diane Swonk, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Richard Silla, thanks to you.
Thank you.
Richard Silla is professor of economics at New York University's Stern School of Business, co-author of A History of U.S. Interest Rates, and Diane Swonk is senior managing director and chief economist at Mesirow Financial. You've heard of tax evasion, but how about tax inversion? One is illegal and completely understandable. You don't want to pay taxes, so you don't. Then you go to jail. That's evasion. The other is legal and completely indecipherable. I don't want to pay U.S. taxes, so I move to a country, say Greece, and renounce my citizenship of my company, but not my own passport. And then I come home as an American working for a foreign company and pay no taxes here and lower taxes there. This is already happening. Did Ireland offer such a sweet tax deal to Apple? The European Commission is currently investigating the tech behemoth's arrangement with the Irish government. Could this be a sign that after years of public indifference, the tide might finally be turning on the issue of tax inversions? Another sign, when the news broke that Pfizer was merging with Allergan for a cool $152 billion, the fact that the new joint company would be based in Dublin was, to put it mildly, a shocker. Hedrick Smith, executive editor of ReclaimTheAmericanDream.org, says it's time to connect the dots between two issues the American public feels strongly about: corporate campaign finance contributions and corporate tax inversions.
The voters and the ordinary public see corporate money and billionaire money flowing into the campaigns, and they're upset about it. And then every once in a while, a story such as the one just a few days ago about Pfizer, the big drug company, forming a merger with an Irish company, $150 billion merger, in order to become an Irish citizen, to give up its American citizenship and to duck its U.S. taxes. Now, that's happened with close to 50 large American companies over the last decade or so. Treasury Department estimates it's cost about $40 billion in U.S. taxes, which the ordinary taxpayer is going to have to pay. But I don't think that most people make a connection between the two. Right now is a good time to look at it. Well, most people are out in the holiday season shopping for gifts for their friends, and the corporations are out shopping for candidates across the country. There's an interesting group called the Public Interest Research Group, and they published a map the other day that showed the largest corporate contributors to congressional campaigns all across the country. If you lived in Texas, it was Lockheed Martin. If you lived in Tennessee, it was FedEx. If you lived in Florida, Iowa, it was AT&T. Now, we tend to focus on what the people are doing, the corporations are doing in the presidential campaign, but they spend a whopping amount of money buying friends in Congress.
What's happened when lawmakers have tried to buck this trend of what's called inversions when corporations go overseas?
Well, as you suggest, not everybody's happy with this idea. The president suggested closing the loophole. There are even Republicans on Capitol Hill that have suggested closing the loophole. The former chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, which is the committee that writes tax legislation, a Michigan Republican named Dave Camp, came up with a corporate tax reform plan in 2014. And he's a very popular conservative Republican. And the business people love the idea of a corporate tax reform because they thought they were going to get a reduction in the corporate tax rate from about 35% to 25%. But in order not to lose revenue, Camp proposed closing the loophole on some of these corporate inversions and the corporate use of tax havens overseas. And he ran into a buzzsaw of opposition from the very people who encouraged him to push for a tax reform. Within about 48 hours of his surfacing this plan, business groups had gone to their friends in Congress, and 50 Republicans in the House came out publicly against Camp's plan, which they had backed only 3 or 4 days before.
I'm just wondering why lawmakers get so much cover here. I mean, this is an issue that President Obama and Donald Trump seem to agree on, which makes it unusual. Yet the support for these inversions goes unreported in local districts, and people aren't held to account except when you report on this.
Well, I think part of it is it's a complicated issue. Taxes are always complicated. This gets lost in the weeds of the tax code. People will say, let's control corporate spending and campaigns, but they don't make the connection which we're making right now. And the local media doesn't understand. I mean, I did quite a good deal of research to put together the blog that I've written for the website. It isn't simple to dig into these weeds. So I think the public is basically uninformed. They don't make the connection. And because they don't, there's no heat on the Congress to deliver.
What is the share of corporate taxes in the federal treasury now compared to a generation ago?
Well, that's what's striking. This is where it seems to me the public might wake up. If you go back to the 1950s, corporate taxes accounted for roughly 30% of the overall tax take. You've got individual taxes, corporate taxes, special fees, and then, of course, you have Social Security and Medicare taxes, which have gone up tremendously. And so over the last 30 or 40 years, the corporate share of taxes have gone down from 30% to about 10% today. And guess who's picking up the tab? You and me and everybody else across the country. So that if these corporate inversions go on, the Treasury Department says we collectively are all going to have to kick in $40 billion more so that Pfizer and Apple and the rest of them can get away with shenanigans like corporate inversions and using tax havens overseas to stash their earnings so they don't get taxed or they get taxed at a very, very low rate.
So people who buy Apple products think of themselves as very smart, but actually they've been outsmarted by Apple, in your view.
Apple is unbelievably clever. What Apple does is it comes up with a new wrinkle or two or 10 or 20 for its iPhones and its iPads. And it's done by engineers and designers and computer guys in Cupertino, California, where they have their labs and their research work. But what Apple does is it assigns the patent on all those new gimmicks to its Irish subsidiary. So when you're buying a cell phone at an Apple store in America, the profit is actually being taken by the Irish subsidiary of Apple, which is paying a 6.3% tax rate instead of a 35% American tax rate. Starbucks does it too. It shifted the secret formula for its coffee roasting to a subsidiary overseas in Europe. And Caterpillar shifts the billing for its heavy earth-making equipment, moving equipment, tractors and the like that it makes in Illinois. It shifted the billing to its Swiss subsidiary. The Swiss sent out the bills. The money came back to the Swiss, and Caterpillar said, hey, this is really profits for our Swiss subsidiary. They saved $2 or $3 billion in taxes simply by sending the bills out from a place overseas. So the corporations are extraordinarily clever. They're getting away with murder.
Corporate America is way ahead of us in deciphering the American tax code. It's talked about on ReclaimTheAmericanDream.org. Hedrick Smith is executive editor of ReclaimTheAmericanDream.org. Thanks so much, Rick.
Good to be with you, John.
You had me from the start, won't let this end. First you want to go to the left, then you want to turn right.
Justin Bieber rides a hoverboard and everyone wants one, right? You've no doubt heard about the problems with the self-balancing scooter platforms called hoverboards. They come from a technology originally made for electric wheelchairs, a technology that became the familiar Segway, and now the balancing motors are being popped on a frame along with new hot lithium-ion batteries, and the rush to market has brought more than a few problems. Joining us now is Joshua Horowitz, writer for Quartz. Joshua, do you have a hoverboard yourself?
I don't. In Hong Kong, there's not really much space to use one. And actually, recently, they were declared illegal in Hong Kong. So, you know, for my own well-being, I don't have one with me right now.
What's the problem with the hoverboards? Part of it is technology and manufacturing, but part of it is also the way in which technology can be, bought wholesale and brands can be plopped on things that can be made generic very, very easily. What's going on here?
Well, part of the issue is the battery that powers the hoverboard is known as the lithium-ion battery, and it's in a very effective form of power, but it also happens to explode or set fire very easily, particularly when new hot products hit the market. And we saw that in the early 2000s with laptops, and then throughout that decade in China, there were a lot of cheaply manufactured smartphones that suffered from the same problem. What's happened now with hoverboards is actually very similar to what happened in China with those cheap knockoff smartphones. The demand for hoverboards has just exploded. It's grown so quickly in the United States. And what's happened is that manufacturers in China have caught on to this trend and have been able to sell these devices to American consumers and consumers in other parts of the world faster than regulation has been able to keep up with them, and also faster than any one single brand that is able to take the time and make sure that manufacturing standards are up to par can kind of achieve the popularity necessary to be that number one reliable brand.
And the interesting new thing, aside from the batteries, is the idea that with Alibaba there in China, I can make an order for, 10,000 hoverboards on the wholesale exchange and have them plop a label on it that says Hako board or something like that and have it be my own personal brand and get them shipped to the United States. And they come in as toys, not necessarily as wholesale products that need to be checked by the government for safety.
That's correct. Yeah. They've become so popular so fast that many of these importers, many of these hoverboard brands are really just importers of other products. Funky Duck, which is one of the better known brands in the United States, for example, they used to be importers of iPhone cases. And then I spoke with another brand in New Jersey that's known as Galaxy Board, and they used to be a pillow importer. And it's very, very easy for an enterprising importer to kind of see this trend coming, someone who kind of knows his way around Alibaba and maybe knows a few people in China, and to say, hey, listen, I want 1,000, 10,000 hoverboards. But these people might not have the engineering background necessary or the understanding of consumer electronics and supply chain to vet this particular type of product for quality and safety. Another reason why this product is so interesting and why we're seeing these accidents happen is because this product is embroiled in a very, very bitter patent battle. An inventor, an engineer from Seattle named Shane Chun claimed to have the patent for the hoverboards that we see on YouTube with Justin Bieber, that specific device. And yet recently, a Chinese company that bought Segway and also bought the patents owned by Segway claims that it owns the patents. And the court hasn't really decided who's the winner. And also, there's lawsuits that are going on in China and the U.S. between these two parties and also other parties, other manufacturers, distributors, importers. That's just left this huge void for these smaller importers to take advantage of that and say, well, we're not going to, it's going to be a while before we get slammed for violating IP or patents. So we may as well just get on the train quickly.
The future of the hoverboard hovers somewhere out there in legal limbo. Meanwhile, the demand is exploding. All that is true, literally and figuratively. Joshua, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, John.
Joshua Horowitz is a writer for Quartz. He spoke to us from Hong Kong. With Star Wars, The Force Awakens coming out, hovering like a giant mothership over everything in life right now, you may be finding it hard to ignore. And then there's those of you who know nothing about Star Wars. You came of age during the unwatchable Sith episodes, perhaps, and you really haven't checked the whole Star Wars scene out. That is you, a Star Wars virgin, or as they say in Huttese, a wormo, kind of a dunce, clueless. This is your 2015 holiday party nightmare.
Cantina Bar? What the hell is this?
Hey there, Jeff. Or should I say Luke? The size matters not. Look at me. Judge me by my size, do you?
What are you talking about, Susan?
A joke, young Jedi. Don't worry. So great to see you. What's that costume?
I'm not wearing a costume.
Right, and I'm not Yoda. I suppose the next thing you're going to tell me is that you can't speak Huttese. Okay, drinks over here, lightsabers over there. It is so good to see you. Ichiwawa, as we say in Ewok. Thanks for coming, Wormo.
All right, what is the deal here? What's a Wormo? What kind of party is this? It says on the invitation, bring the Force with you. What does that mean? Dale? Dale, is that you in there? Are you in some kind of wolf bear thing? What are you wearing? You kind of sound ill, dude.
Get back to Kashyyyk, Wookiee.
Right. Hello. All right. Somebody needs to tell me what's going on. Translate something for me.
Shuda means greeting. Naga.
What do you want?
Dopo Migusa Pinuki.
Do you feel lucky, punk?
Okay.
Always two there are, master and apprentice.
You write that in Orabesh, or is that from one of the clone languages?
This is crazy. I'm out of here. Jimmy, can I get a ride home?
Sorry, brah. My pod racer only fits one.
Don't worry, you're back in the real world. In a survey conducted last year by 538, 15% of male respondents and 21% of respondents overall said they hadn't seen a single Star Wars film. So you're not alone. Jeff Fertig would fall into that category. He's an employee at the offices of Mashable.
Yes, that's true.
I imagine a few people might have seen Star Wars at Mashable.
Yeah, we definitely have an office of Star Wars obsessives. Absolutely.
So what's it like for you?
Well, that segment you just played was uncomfortably familiar. I've never seen Star Wars. I didn't want to say anything about it my first few months of employment. I didn't want to get fired. And it's come out through this piece that I've worked on for Mashable about having never seen Star Wars.
Now, you didn't really think you were going to get fired if you didn't know about it, did you?
I had no idea. This was my first time working at a place like Mashable. I just didn't want to risk it. My parents were very proud of me, and I didn't want to chance it.
Now, why did you miss Star Wars? Were you out of the country? Were you in a deep coma?
I've been watching Transparent.
That's very recent.
Before Transparent, I think I was just an outsider to it. My dad he never made me watch it. He was a bit of a fan. I read about this a little bit in my feature. I was the type of guy who was, I was rollerblading listening to Will Smith's Switch across 11 repeated tracks on my Discman around when other people were binging Star Wars. That was my jam.
And you came of age around the time that the Lucas episodes came out, which weren't necessarily must-watch movie fare.
Oh, yeah. Those just flew right by me. I didn't even know that those had happened until I was working on this piece, actually.
So you have a decision to make about this movie. Are you going to go and not know all the references, or are you going to go with a friend with a dictionary? Or
for me, this journey, as you had mentioned, I'm a Star Wars virgin, and I think that describes this journey because for me it was kind of a sexual experience in seeing am I going to get into the bedchamber with Star Wars? And after seeing a lot of the culture, I think I realized this isn't for me. Just like I would realize with any potential mate, this may not be for me.
Sexual, get into the bedchamber.
Yeah, I just –
that's a little creepy.
As I would talk about with any potential mate, I wanted to get references based on the culture of Star Wars. So I spoke with, you know, I spoke with an astrophysicist from the Hayden Planetarium. I met with the New York Jedi, and I realized I really felt like an outsider in this culture. And I realized that this is not something that I want to get into bed with.
Now, you are wearing a bathrobe that makes you look like a Jedi something or other.
John, that's a common misconception. It's a Jedi robe. And it is my girlfriend's Jedi robe, and she gratefully – it's because I was knighted as a Jedi Master last week, despite having never seen the franchise.
Wait a minute. How can this be? Your girlfriend is in bed with you, apparently, mm-hmm. and you know nothing about Star Wars, and she gives you this Jedi robe.
Well, she had this Jedi robe from her previous days, I guess, as a female Jedi, which is definitely a thing I learned at New York Jedi, the institution that anointed me a Jedi Master. And once I did, she allowed me to wear this robe out in public anytime I might desire.
Well, Jake, you're on your way, it sounds like.
Thank you. Thank you.
Jake Furtig, video producer at Mashable. Are you going to see the movie, by the way?
We'll see. I'm doubtful, but I may, as a novelty.
All right, Jake, you got some work cut out for you.
Well, thank you, John.
Back in 1991, there was a news revolution you may have missed, unless you were a 10-year-old. Nick News, the news for kids on the Nickelodeon network, began as a trailblazing good idea for filling infinite cable time and became the indispensable longest-running news program for kids. The program has given kids a way of talking about climate change, about wars, autism, alcoholism, homelessness, and racism, to just name a few topics.
When is it time for giving? And should Christmas be the only time to think about the homeless?
Before I was homeless, I was really popular at school and stuff. And now I've just changed a lot and I'm not that popular anymore.
Why is this man so important? And what is Malcolm X teaching us 27 years after his death?
If you want your freedom, you gotta fight for it.
Find out this week on the show that asks the question.
For the entirety of its 25 years, Linda Ellerbee has been the host of Nick News. She created the program. But tonight, Ellerbee hangs up her hat, and Nick News will air for the final time. Ellerbee, who began in network news for adults, made a huge name for herself before striking out on her own as an independent producer. She said she'd worked for so many spoiled, immature baby executives at the big networks that doing Nick News was a natural and a relief.
When Nickelodeon walked in the door in 91 and asked us to do a special for kids trying to explain what was what we now call Gulf War I, we did it, not really knowing if we had any idea of what we were doing. And Nickelodeon liked it and asked us to invent a new series for kids. And we came up with rules back then that stayed in effect, and they were pretty simple. They were, we would not lie to our audience. We would not talk down to our audience. We would work on the assumption that our audience was smart. We would recognize that nothing was simple in this world, that it wasn't a black and white world, that it was gray, and that sometimes questions were better than answers, and sometimes there was more than one answer to a question. And finally, that technology was reducing the world so that we could never, ever again afford to ignore what went on in the rest of the world. And that while we were paying attention to that, we needed desperately to remember that in the end, we were all more alike than we were different. And when we were done with that, I looked at it and I started laughing and I said, these are the same rules that I worked by in grown-up news. There is no change. The only things that we changed for the 25 years that we were on the air, we added the component that although you may feel like you're powerless, you are not. Hmm. You have a voice. Use it. And you can change your world, and you can start now. And the big rule was that wherever in the world you find bad things happening, and they do happen, if you look hard, you will also always find good people trying to make a bad situation better.
And when did you realize that you might be having an influence on the kids that you reach?
Well, I think somewhere along the way, we began to realize that it was working, that a lot of kids were following us, and that equally important, a lot of families were watching the show. It was a way to get topics, to get discussions going. If you didn't know how to talk to your kids about AIDS, our show was going to show you how. I'm going to give kids an insight into this disease and what was going on. And because of the people on the show, it was actually going to leave them unable to ever say again, I don't know anybody who has AIDS.
Did it develop that they would look forward to your programs, but with a little bit of what are they going to do now? Because you always were going to push it. Yeah,
that's true. And I'm rather proud of that, actually.
What programs do you think represent that?
Oh, well, the one that most represented it was the show we did about children who had same-sex parents. It was the first time we ever touched the issue of gay on our kids' show. And I went there after discovering that fag was the most common hate word on America's elementary and middle school playgrounds. And what happened was the far right wing set up several websites that all you had to do was push a button to generate an email to Nickelodeon and say, we would never watch again, and we'll never allow our children to watch again. We will stop all support from every sponsor on you. And it crashed my email. Of course, none of the people writing had seen the show. Not one of them. Because the show hadn't been produced yet. The day it aired, there was so much noise about this little show, which people hadn't seen, that it ended up being the ticker tape story in Times Square, and I was debating Falwell on CNN just before the show went on, and it had become its own news story. And all the result, of course, was only that we had the highest ratings of any show we'd ever put on the air. Mm. And nothing bad happened. And, you know, cut to this year, when one of the last shows we did was Coming Out, which was a show in which middle school kids looked straight into the camera and, uninterrupted by us, told their stories.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long way to go.
There's an Ellerbe voice. There's an Ellerbe sense of candor and no-nonsense that comes in that even the kids pick up on. Did you ever encounter a kid grasping from you this sense of, I can tell it my own way. I've got permission from that woman over there in the corner.
You know, I think possibly one of the nicest compliments I was ever paid in my life is a couple of years ago, we won the Edward R. Murrow Award for Best Documentary of the Year. It was the first time ever that a children's show had won that award. And we never nominated ourselves for it. It never occurred to us. It's a grown-up category, Best Documentary of the Year. You're competing with Ken Burns. You're competing
with
you know, all the big guys and all the networks. They gave it to us. Aaron Brown, who was an anchor at CNN, gave me the award, and he said something I will never forget. He said, the two most important women in TV news are Barbara Walters and Linda Ellerbe. Barbara Walters made it possible for you to be on television. Linda Ellerbe made it possible for you to be you on television. I will never
get
a better compliment than that. And when I announced the retirement, I got all these tweets and all these emails and all this stuff of young people posting photographs of them anchoring television news or working in newsrooms and saying, I am doing this because I grew up watching you. And you inspired me to work in journalism.
Linda Ellerbe, thank you so much and the best of luck.
Ah, thank you. I think I've had the best of luck, John. Mm-hmm.
Linda Ellerbe has been the host of Nick News for 25 years. The final episode of Nick News airs tonight on Nickelodeon. And here's something to take with you today.
Inconceivable!
What film do you think Senator Ted Cruz can recite from memory? It's not Star Wars.
And remember, this is for posterity, so be honest.
No more guesses. We have a winner. The Princess Bride, the 1987 classic, in which Mandy Patinkin portrayed Inigo Montoya. Patinkin, who also played the major spook boss at the CIA in the series Homeland, is about as far as you can get from the Tea Party politically, and he's less than thrilled with Senator Cruz's interpretation. As he told our partner, the New York Times, this man is not putting forth ideas that are at the heart of what that movie is all about. I would love for Senator Cruz and everyone creating fear-mongering and hatred to consider creating hope, optimism, and love. Open your arms to these people, he says to Senator Cruz, these refugees trying to get in our country, and open your hearts. Yeah, that'll happen. Sure. Sure, Mandy. Knock yourself out. Knock yourself out, buddy. Give us your take at 8778MYTAKE and send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, working to find cures for leukemia, lymphoma, Hodgkin's disease, and myeloma, improve the quality of life for patients and their families, and ensure access to treatments for patients. LLS.org.
The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.